No, it is true. I do like I like to hear what you're thinking so that I can respond. I want to hear any questions, objections, hallelujahs in equal measure. Objections are helpful, right? Because that's how we'll figure out, we help you learn something, or perhaps you can school me. I certainly don't know everything. As you mentioned, it is part three of six. So at the end of today, we'll be halfway through. And so far, I've gone fairly, I don't want to say slowly, but kind of gently, because there's a lot of places you can go with this, and some of them take a bit of explaining, a bit of thinking about. So I've tried to sort of, what this is all about, to a large degree, is about this idea of Buddhism and science, and there's been these ongoing dialogues for maybe 30, 40 years, probably, starting with the Mind and Life Institute and so on. It's quite exciting. Actually, it's a really exciting field. It's the area of my PhD. It's the area where we're starting to get a lot of kind of the benefits of this ancient wisdom for things like mental health and other things. But up to now, I think it's fair to say, for the most part, in this so-called dialogue, it's the scientific community has not been particularly, I'm going to be polite, have not been especially interested in what the contemplatives have to say, right? They're interested in their brain states when they meditate. This is, you know, that's like super sexy. That's what everyone wants to know. You know, that's happening. But actually, the idea that just as you've trained a biologist to use an electron microscope, or you've trained an astronomer to use a radio telescope, and then you develop hypotheses, you test the hypotheses, and they're highly trained people who've put years and years and years into their skill to use technology to make discoveries, then there actually have been people doing the same thing for thousands of years. It's just that they've been turning internally, they've been looking at mental states and the mind. So, which is to say, mental states and the area or the place in which those mental states occur. And so over time, there has been more and more interest, I'm pleased to say, in what the contemplative side brings to the table. And so what I have done so far, it's only been two sessions, but what I've done so far is try to sort of help, if you like, help the people who are here watching start to think about it from this contemplative side, right? It's pretty easy to find out what the scientists are thinking and looking into and trying to understand. That's everywhere. And if you're not sure where, just let me know, because I'll send you in the right direction. But there's very little on this other direction. And so just to tidy up a couple of things from last week, there was one, and I don't remember exactly how it came about, but somebody was unclear or unhappy with my treatment of the behaviorists. And I think perhaps we're talking about different people. And so I thought I would just give you the example. So John Watson, kind of father of behaviorism, if you like, in around the 1920, something like that. I'm not 100% sure, maybe earlier. He said this, you know, psychology must, quote, never use the terms consciousness, mental states, mind content, introspectively verifiable, imagery, and the like, right? So if you want to know about, you know, these are the people I'm talking about who I think cause so much harm, these are the attitudes I'm talking about. We want to talk about psychology and what's going on with the mind, but we can't talk about mental states. This was, you know, what people believed for a long time. And it still influences psychology heavily today. And of course, this sort of progeny, Skinner, I have a different view here. I can't read it. I need to bring my glasses. After substituting brain for mind, we can then move on to substituting person for brain. I mean, that is just nonsensical. What is felt or introspectively observed is not an important part of the physiology. Right. So just be clear about, we're not talking about people who think, yeah, you can know your own state of mind, and what you think about your thoughts and how you observe them is unimportant. In fact, it goes further. If you've ever read up on Anne Treisman and these sorts of people, they just go ahead and claim that your mental activity doesn't exist at all. Hmm. And this is like, was she at the head of the cognitive psych faculty at Yale or Harvard? I'm not sure. Like, these are not dumb people. These are smart people saying dumb things.
So, Corey, is this like psychology has moved on, psychoanalysis has moved on from Freud and is quite different from Freud now? So is behaviorism different now from Skinner and Watson?
Yeah, is behaviorism different than Skinner and Watson? Yeah, I hope so. I don't know. I'm so uninterested in it, I've never bothered to check. So yeah, I don't know. Because, you know, if you remember in the first couple of weeks, I was saying at some point in maybe the 60s through to the 80s, the cognitive psychologists took over and they had this sort of sense where instead of thinking of the mind as this black box we can never know anything about, it's like, oh, what are these cognitive processes? What are the biases that give rise to this behavior? It's a really exciting time, in my opinion, in psychology. And the part that, of course, gets me really excited is they get interested in just what happens when any of your five senses or the mental domain, if any of your experiential domains meet with some kind of object, whether it's a physical, tangible object you see, hear, smell, taste, touch, whether it's something you remember, something you think of, that what is the, is there a discrepancy between what's presented to those areas of those sort of cognitions, if you like? Is there a difference between what's presented and how I interpret it? And this is really exciting because the answer is almost certainly yes, and it's the heart of a lot of the malaise that many of us would feel, whether it's a clinical diagnosis or not. And, of course, it's, you're starting to really talk about the very root of all suffering from a Buddhist point of view, which seems like it'd be something we might be, you know, interested in. So, so the idea being that the they did move on and they still moved on in neuroscience, and there's all sorts of interesting stuff happening.
So your pal, the behaviorist online, says, yes, we're very different now.
Yeah,
we believe in mental states but use different language so we can use measurement.
Yeah, fair enough. Good, good. Yeah, I mean, there's no point in thinking like these people. It's hard, though, like these people I'm pointing at, Skinner and Watson. If you want to talk about behavior, in fact, I'll send you an article this week because you can go the reverse direction. What's it been, 10 minutes and I haven't even got to the slides yet. You can go in the opposite direction. And so, say, neuroscience is really interesting. A lot of neuroscientists are looking into, say, what individual neural paths and these sorts of things are going on in the brain, which and ignoring behavior, like just going in this whole other direction. And that information is also totally useless, actually. You can't study, like, the brain independent of behavior. And there's this brilliant, I mean, it's just, brilliant analogy, and I'll send you the article I'm taking this from. In fact, I wish I had a video for it. You know, murmurations, do you know this word? It's so fun to say, a murmuration. When you see like starlings or sparrows and they go on these crazy, like, you know, all sorts of all over the sky. And so if there's any zoologists or something, I'll probably get this a bit wrong, but essentially we know why it happens, and it's just to do with mathematical calculations. Each individual bird is trying to stay a certain amount of distance away from the other bird, right? And so then you get these completely unpredictable, really wild patterns in the sky. But you can't predict those patterns by knowing the maths that the bird is doing, if you like. And the same is true in the brain. The brain is far, 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 like a million times more complicated than a flock of starlings in terms of permutations and combinations of things. And you can't look at the brain and predict behavior. You can watch behavior and then see what's correlated in the brain, and that's really interesting. But you can't watch the brain and know what's going to happen behaviorally because there's so many variations and so on that it's not going to matter. I can tell you, a neuroscientist, a friend of mine, he was sort of laughing about the field in a way a little while ago we were talking, and he said, people just don't understand. It's like, I can watch and I can know your motor cortex is firing in real time, but unless you tell me you're picking up a pen, I don't know. Yeah, like just something simple as picking up a pen, I don't know, just from looking at the data. So like there's a big over, and so we've gone this whole other shift away from the behaviors back into this brain thing, which is unfortunate. And of course, what's going to happen, and the whole history of science is like this, is people pushing to one extreme and then people pushing back to the other extreme, then finally someone else just sailing down the middle going, you're both half right, and it's here. And this is what, you know, science is sort of starting to do, which coincidentally is something Buddhism has been doing for 2,500 years, in which you understand the extremes of views, and that's how you understand the middle way, because Buddhism is about the middle way entirely. And so those views are best understood when you understand each extreme. We'll come to that in coming weeks. I've overshot, I blame the coffee. Okay. So just really quick recap, and I'm going to add to it. We talked about this the last couple of weeks, that Buddhism and science are doing very similar things, trying to get extremely hidden phenomena to become manifest phenomena, in which you need theories and then you need technology to do so. The example I have given from a Buddhist perspective, causes of suffering, karma, rebirth. These are things that play out over multiple lives. So you can't necessarily just know them without some work. And they become manifest through the contemplative technology and hypothesis testing. Look into this. The most perfect example, of course, is Ptolemy tries to figure out how things work because the Earth is in the center of the solar system, which is what the Bible told him, which was the fundamental source for scientists in the beginning. Then you have this hidden Copernicus figured it out mathematically but couldn't prove it, and Galileo did it, and he did it with technology, which is the telescope. So I'm going to present a new one just to get the idea. Here's an extremely hidden alleged fact. Consciousness and mental disorders arise from the brain. So there are people who believe this, a lot of neuroscientists who sort of have taken over, not quite like a church-like thing, but, you know, they're really the authorities, if you like, about a lot of psychology. A lot of neuroscientists, not all of them, would say this. There's some proof. We have pharmacology. So we know that if we, serotonin reuptake inhibitors, for example. So if we increase levels of serotonin in your brain, we think that helps temporarily until you have a relapse, which 60 to 80% of people do. So that can help with depression and so on. So there is a theory that perhaps, altering the brain alters these conscious states and so on, but it's pretty untested. And I mentioned last week this book by Johann Hari called Lost Connections, which is really, really important. If you're interested in anxiety and depression, you should read this book. And because there's a lot of heavy researchers explaining why this chemical imbalance myth that we have about anxiety and depression is exactly that. It's just some more neuromythology, really. And so then what that means then is you have, in terms of making the position that brain mental disorders and consciousness arise from the brain, you can't make it a manifest phenomenon. You can't make it evident because there's no technology to establish this.
There is a correlation between the mental disorders and the brain, but you can't tell if it's a cause or a result.
That's right. You can't tell if there's a... Can people on Zoom hear you speaking?
Yeah, they
right?
can.
Yeah, awesome. So that's right. And we can go there if you like, because I do worry that some of you are sort of keeping quiet when really you're silently objecting. Because I've thrown out a few things in the last few weeks that I really expected pushback from, and then I didn't get it. So I'm not sure if you just sort of come around or...
I think Queenslanders are just very well behaved.
Right, could be. So of course, and we can look at this, and it's an important point. You know, we're talking about neurocorrelates, right? And there's, I forget if it was 20 plus billion euro was spent trying to find the neurocorrelates of consciousness, which you do by eliminating everything that you know the brain does. Because neuroscience is 100% statistics, right? Like 100%. You run the brain, you say, do this, and then you see what the brain does, right? And you say, do this, and you see what the brain does. You say, do nothing, and you see what the brain does. And then you have to eliminate all that. And then you say, hey, you know, do the actual task, right? Do that. And then, so then you get these brain movements, and you have to look at them and pull all this other stuff away. I mean, it's impressive. But it's not very solid, really. And so when you talk about a neurocorrelate, right, and if you understand correlation, this won't be hard. What, for example, a neurocorrelate of compassion, there's a lot of work in this, really worthwhile. But if you can be absolutely certain that one thing that a neurocorrelate of compassion is not, the one thing in the whole universe that it definitely isn't, is compassion, right? Otherwise, you would just call it compassion. You wouldn't call it something that happens in the brain that's related to compassion, right? And then by using the very word correlation, you don't know if that brain activity is the thing that gives rise to compassion, or if compassion gives rise to the brain activity. That's what correlation means. So yeah, if you do, let's oversimplify, because I'm fond of that. It's easy. If we measure your brain activity, we do some neuroimaging as you are developing compassion, and then mine, there will be similar areas activated in the brain. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And what are they? They're neurocorrelates. That's what we call them, right? So what they are is physiology. It's things going on in the brain that are correlated with compassion, right? Which means they're not compassion. Yeah, I mean that's sort of the way it works. It's related to, and it's not. I sometimes come across as if I think finding the neurocorrelates of compassion is a waste of time, and I don't think that. What I think is there are some untested hypotheses before you get to this, which is what I'd like to look at. Is that all right? Have I covered that okay? Because, as I said, I'm fond of the interruptions, okay? Okay, please do. Keep interrupting. So here's what we've got. We've got there's no scientific technology to test these above assumptions. That is, that consciousness arises from the brain, right? There isn't any. There's a bigger problem that no one's interested in testing this hypothesis. It's actually a much bigger problem. And with all due respect, the field of psychology and neuroscience, and you know, I'm in the middle of a PhD in psychology, so it's not like I want you to shoot it all down. They're operating on these untested beliefs. And I use the term belief very deliberately because that's what they are. Consciousness arises from the brain, that's a belief. Okay? It's not a completely crazy idea. Right? There's a belief because it's untested, and there's not even theory that's rock solid, okay, to back that up. So here's a 125 odd years ago, one of the fathers of psychology, William James, came up with these three hypotheses about the brain and consciousness. I find this really interesting. He decided that the brain produces thoughts the way an electric current produces light, or the brain enables or permits mental events as the trigger of a crossbow releases an arrow by removing the obstacle that holds the string, which is so clever. I really like that. And third, the brain transmits thoughts as a prism transmits light, reflecting it into a spectrum of colors. Okay, so here are these three hypotheses. And he wanted them tested. And of course, he wanted them tested partly by introspection, by people observing their own mental states, which, you know, as we've mentioned, got steamrolled by the behaviorists. But it's interesting because two of these, at least, certainly the third one, presents consciousness as perhaps not being made of atoms, not being derived from something physical, which is an interesting take for his time. So, however, none of these two, as I said, have been tested within science. They've been well tested in Asia and other places. But it's interesting. So there's discussion was already happening over 100 years ago that, oh, you know, maybe the brain is some sort of medium. You know, maybe it's not generating consciousness. But what happened is we just decided at some point that it does, that everything comes from physical things, and we've operated on that assumption ever since from a scientific perspective. And not without beneficial results, right? I mean, we have treatments for all sorts of things. We've learned all sorts of stuff. There's things going on about, say, in terms of Parkinson's, is really fascinating. You know, these sorts of neurodegenerative diseases. We're learning a lot about it. So it's not like I want them to stop, right? But they're just these really big assumptions. And here's the issue, right? If we have somebody with clinical depression, and we know that a lot of that is due to what we call a cognitive style. That is to say, we fall heavily into a negativity bias, catastrophize, and so on, and make things a little worse than they are. But not just that, but we keep it up. We edit out things that go well, and these sorts of things happen. This is not, it's not rocket science. You know, it's not like that. That's sort of, in general, a bit how depression might work. And then we know that we come and we intervene. So we give some sort of antidepressants, and it actually lifts. It interferes with this way of thinking for quite some time, often many as 4, 6, even 8 months, right? And then, as I've mentioned, up to 80% of people relapse completely, and you have to change the medication. And you go, many of you will be familiar with this, at least anecdotally. And that way of operating assumes that all the conscious states, disorders are arising from the brain, right? If it's the case that actually consciousness is being sort of refracted through the brain, or that the brain is some kind of medium for consciousness and conscious experience, that is a hypothesis worth testing, because it means that this constant sort of trauma of changing medications and so on, we can do away with it and start thinking about the actual source. And what's the source? The source is still this cognitive style. But this cognitive style of catastrophizing isn't something that arises from the brain. Perhaps it's something that comes, that the brain is mediating, and that even if you go in and sort of artificially, you know, alter it with antidepressants, that the fundamental cause, which is the cognitive catastrophizing style, is still there. Where is it? In their consciousness. It's an important question to ask, and it hasn't been asked in science. The question hasn't been asked. I'm not saying it hasn't been answered. I'm saying it hasn't been asked. And it's about time that it was. And it is actually more and more. So I shouldn't be too, now I'm catastrophizing. But it is actually coming along. We should be optimistic. And so, I've presented this, this is supposed to be a review, but I've already gone off on so many tangents. I have this idea of the stimulus, mental activity and behavior, and that the cognitive psychologist who I mentioned before got really interested in that. And I've presented these sort of three trainings, or the three core elements of Buddhism that are about ethical discipline, concentration, and we saw wisdom or knowledge or understanding. It's a hard word to translate. Kind of map onto this quite well. And so what I'd like to do then, and for the next couple of weeks, is sort of look at these through some lenses that you won't have heard before, I think, if you're Buddhist, and probably not if you're sort of from a science side either, or there's another option, you're neither of those. So in ethical discipline, we're looking at, like, let's talk about prioritizing humane outcomes. That is to say, having changes of your behavior that bring about, that eliminate destructive sort of reactions and problems with, let's say, destructive emotional reactions and behavior, and bring about constructive reactions, right? Collaboration and these sorts of things. So that's what ethical discipline is essentially about. And it settles it down and stables our minds enough to start talking about concentration. Concentration is the telescope, right? It's the technology, it's the contemplative technology. And then you get this wisdom side of things, or vipassana in Sanskrit, or vipassana, insight, which is how you use that technology for hypothesis testing. And the hypothesis testing, from a Buddhist perspective, that's the elimination of suffering, actually, reduction all the way through to elimination. So, you know, from a Buddhist perspective, it's fairly important. And I didn't want to start with this or tell you I was going to do this, because personally, you know, if I'd said, hey, we're going to talk about ethics, I reckon half of you wouldn't have come. And fair enough. So, but I'm going to talk about it in a way that, again, is a little bit perhaps unique. And I just say before the Buddhists get their backs up.
Don't worry, it happens in Buddhist classes too. I never tell anyone the next class on ethics.
No, it's too boring. So remember what I'm trying to do here as much as I can is find these, if not common grounds, but find ways we can talk about these things that make sense to everyone, right? By drawing in as many Buddhist elements that are authentic and keeping scientific elements that are also authentic. I was going to give you a review. I'll do it really fast. In ethical discipline, there's lots to it, but from a Buddhist perspective, there are three main levels, if you like, three main subtleties. And this is only interesting because the first one we call pratamoksha, which means individual liberation. And these, so there are these five vows. These are for lay people. Monastic vows also in this category, right? Pratamoksha, of course, there's hundreds and hundreds of them. And we're not actually allowed to know what they are beforehand. But they all fall into this thing. And the goal of this training is what we call liberation, right? So this is the sort of thing that Buddhists in Thailand and Burma and parts of China are pushing for, right? And then it's not what the Buddha did, right? They're trying to do something that's maybe not quite as as intense. Anyway, that's not so important. What's interesting about this is that they're all basically physical, right? They're restraint of behavior. If you think about this idea of stimulus, cognitive activity, and behavior. Then there's another level we call the bodhisattva. And so these start to combine. There's a few in there that are mental, but they're still behavioral based. But they're a bit harder for different reasons, not so important. And then there are these other ones, tantric vows or secret mantra is a better translation. What these are is a lot of these are mental. So it's really delving in at this mental level. They're really advanced. You know, they're really hard to keep, actually impossible. Anyway, so we're not so interested in that so much from our perspective. You're looking at this kind of entry-level way of operating, which is restraining our behavior. And why would we do that? So here's what I, rather than talk about rules and vows or I forget what I call them now. I found that thing in the first week. Counter-habitual implementation intentions. Reference that from week one if you missed that. We talk about it in this term because we've already brought this up. These two types of happiness, genuine happiness, hedonic happiness. If you really want to summarize ethical discipline, what you're trying to do is prioritize the former over the latter. And as much as possible, put the latter, that is hedonic sort of resources, into the service of the genuine. This is fundamentally what ethics should do, right? But rather than present this as sort of a side effect, let's look at it as maybe let's put this front and center. So then we don't have to talk about rules and things. Let's just talk about prioritizing genuine well-being over hedonic. Okay. Some of the sources or the causes of this, you know, kindness, compassion, insight, and so on. The particularly kindness and compassion have probably a lot of research behind them in science. The other two, not so much, the idea of insight, but we'll come to that. And so I thought I'd just, there's lots of things I could have shown you, but here's one of my favorites. This is just a correlational study done some time ago. And what you have is a bunch of people together from four different places, Americans, Taiwanese, Russians. I'm not sure where, I think it's from rural Russia, like the former Soviet, I'm not sure of that. What have we got? Americans, Germans, Russians, and Taiwanese, actually, the East Asians. And we measure them once for their motivation to be happy. So figure out how motivated are you to be happy, bang. And then we use instruments to measure how happy they are. And here's what we find. In America, your motivation to pursue happiness is significantly correlated negatively to your overall level of well-being. That is to say, the more you want to be happy, the less happy you are. I would expect it's the same in Australia. Germans, interestingly, just kind of no significance, doesn't matter how much you want to be happy, just kind of level out. But the Russians, and then especially the Taiwanese, the East Asians, it was positively correlated. You've got this idea that the more they wanted to be happy, the happier they actually were. Are you following me? Yeah, individual versus collectivism. And that's, so I'll just shift that over to here, and that's exactly it. So if you look on the left, it's a bit confusing if you haven't read the whole thing. But that the point is that the Russians and the Taiwanese both had really significantly higher levels of socially engaged definitions of happiness. When they talked about being happy, they talked about it collectively. So, you know, you want to be happy, they look around to their community. Was you tell Americans, and I would say Australians, you want to be happy, you go get a massage and buy yourself a pair of new shoes, right? It doesn't work, actually. If you want more information in this, look at Tim Kasser's book, The High Price of Materialism. There's a lot of great research. So my only point in showing this is just an example of the sort of research that's being done into these kindness, compassion type behaviors and how they actually have effects on our mental health. And the jury's in, basically, that it works. Here's the rub then. If that's the situation, so I'm suggesting that rather that our ethical discipline should be rather than ethics and rules, maybe if we thought about it in terms of trying to prioritize these genuine sources of well-being, this eudaimonia we call it, genuine source of well-being over the hedonic, then we might be in a different position. In fact, we might all just behave differently. The whole society would be set up differently. Actually, ours certainly would, right? Where this idea of eudaimonia is a fringe idea, right? And it's blasted by anyone in advertising and marketing who don't want you to believe in it at all, right? So the emphasis is put on the hedonic, and you can look around at the mental health statistics and decide for yourself if you think it's working. And what it comes out with, and so this is maybe veering off a bit, but I wanted to put it out there, that these technologies that we create, in contemplative technologies, it doesn't really, for the most part, it's not going to fall into these traps, actually. Contemplative technology is going to, you're going to use that to decide whether this genuine happiness thing's real, and if you can, you're going to check it out and see how it works and so on. And if you do, you'll probably run with it. For the most part, it's not going to fall into this trap of hedonia, if you like. But it's not true for other technologies, and especially social media, of course. So if you have a look, that's why I wrote this, no technology exists in a vacuum, and then I laughed because, of course, like satellites, right? But I kept it because I just thought, I like being wrong on purpose sometimes. But I don't mean a literal vacuum, I mean a, anyway. So have a think, you know, what the value of, and this is how our society works overall, you know, the value of a tree, a tuna or a person, the value of a tree, you know, roof trusses or floorboards. And we see a tree, the value of that tree is mostly measured in what can I do with it? And just so happens, did you know there's a shortage of roof trusses? It's really interesting. I don't know why, but right now with the whole supply chain. A tuna, right? Sushi or a tin. And a person, you know, we're looking at, we see people, a lot of time we're trying to find them this, you know, can we get labor out of them or their attention out of them and so on, like this, there are these extractive ways of operating. Is that fair enough? Is there any objections? In general, this is pretty much how society works. Yeah, I think GDP. And so it works like this. We have an idea about abstraction. So you see a tree, you abstract it into roof trusses. We call it extraction. The trees are cut down. Depletion. This is a model by Daniel Schmachtenberger, is his name. It's worth looking up. And then pollution, you end up, so you lose the forest, you lose the habitat, you lose the carbon and so on. We increase the carbon, you lose the carbon sequestering. We do with people. And if you think about, you know, when a person wakes up in the morning, of all the things that you could do, I forget the research, but it was something like 85% of college students, the first thing they do is reach for their phone. In the US again, but it would be the same here. And so that's, you take a person, you abstract them into how many units of their attention can I get onto the screen to throw advertising at them? That's how it works, right? You got abstraction. You got extraction, which is the algorithm, the algorithm doesn't operate to sort of push for genuine happiness, it operates to keep you scrolling and so on, right? Then you have depletion, social connections, productivity, and so on, and pollution. Polarization really is the ultimate pollution in this model. And it's not, if you think about this idea of, you know, ethical discipline, so you could come in, and some people are doing this, they're saying, well, we need a different ethical model, which is true, but what if you could just put these two kinds of sources, test out for yourself these different sources of happiness and well-being and run with that? Then this abstraction, extraction, depletion, pollution sort of model that we use is going to kind of fall apart, because none of this is going to work for your sort of eudaimonic well-being, for genuine well-being. You've got another video about happiness. This is only one way to divide it. There's other ways. So what's your, how have you divided?
Well, actually, that my whole course on the happiness came from a talk by B. Alan Wallace that he gave with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and he talked about three levels of happiness, of the hedonic, the eudaimonic, and then what you become, basically. So the Buddhist point would be the stages of enlightenment, so actual realizations. So I'm not sure if he was putting in a Western one and fitting it into a Buddhist terminology, but, you know, the first one, what you get from the world, then the second, what you give to the world, and the third, what you become.
Right.
Enlightened. And then that's a type of well-being that isn't circumstantial, that doesn't depend on our environment or how we're treated, comes entirely from within.
Yeah, I'd like to see the video because...
Was that one of the happiness and its causes?
Yeah, well, it just seems like that all fits into the second, into the eudaimonic type. So talking about this potential of there being three type, a third type. So what you bring to the world, What you get from the world, what you bring to the world, and what you become is what we're talking about, right? And what I'm sort of, what you bring to the world doesn't, I guess, from even as I'm hearing you say this, because I don't go through all that again, but that what you become, even if it's an increased capacity for kindness, compassion, for understanding, for helping others and so on, still falls in the eudaimonic very clearly.
Except the difference that Alan Wallace made was that the eudaimonic happiness still doesn't last forever. That it at some point it wears off. Stages of concentration, being in the zone, being free of all worries, all of that at some point comes to an end.
Yeah, see, what I'm skirting around just out of habit, but I don't sort of have to here, is that the result part you're talking about is very Buddhist.
Yes.
Yeah. So
it's unashamedly Buddhist.
Yeah. So this is one of the problems. We're talking about liberation and enlightenment, which are scientifically unverifiable. It gets a bit problematic. Sure, you can present that the third result, I guess. But if you're going to present that result from that Buddhist perspective, it's a pretty pretty high end achievement. Liberation. We're talking liberation of mind, right?
I mean, true cessations, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's pretty impressive.
You've got to have the whole paradigm.
Yeah.
Kind of like one step, two step,
Yeah, it's a big jump from here. So I guess, yeah, when you're talking about, there is a third, I can even think the Tibetan term he's using. So you talk about contaminated, uncontaminated, and then this idea of definite well-being or definite goodness, we say. I guess so. So yeah, if you want to, I have to have a think about it. From a Buddhist perspective, sure, there's a third type. The trouble is, I guess, if you're trying to talk, if you're talking to people about, say you want to get people to prioritize this idea of genuine happiness over hedonic, because I want to stop this extraction, this abstraction extraction type model, and I would like to see improvement in people's mental health and so on, you can play around with that. I think you're going to lose them when you say, you can also, eliminate suffering altogether if you would only achieve these really high-end levels of concentration and then these really difficult other meditations which bring about the cessation of suffering. I think it'd be a bit hard to convince people of that. Hmm. I mean, not Buddhists, obviously.
No. So my interest was piqued when you said having the hedonic happiness or objects of happiness in the service of eudaimonic happiness, because yeah, I'm thinking, now how does my shoe addiction become in the service of my...
I don't know. I don't think it's
seeking
a
lot
to me at this year.
Like, this is good news, Corey.
Yeah, no, well, you think about hedonic resources, and so if you have an umbrella when it's raining, or you have a drink when you're thirsty, or food when you're hungry, these are hedonic, and you need a certain amount of them. But there is a level, and this to come back to Tim Kasser's work I mentioned before, this the high price of materialism, that we know if you take people who are living below the poverty line, you start to give them money, their overall level of happiness just skyrockets. Right. Until they get up above, when their kids are going to school and they have books and they have clothes and they have everything they need to get around, then you keep giving them more money and it just levels off.
That makes sense.
Like, yeah, of course it would. Yeah. That's what we're talking about, putting them in service of the eudaimonic. So you take this Maslow's hierarchy of needs and so on, you can look it up if you need to. That there is a certain point at which you've got enough, and then it becomes about so-called self-actualization. This is not a Buddhist term. This is something that Maslow used that's quite interesting. But if you want to put that into our perspective, of course, you need to have a certain level of hedonic before you can even talk about genuine. In fact, there are these, I'm going to shoot my mouth off and I'll forget them. There are four things that the Buddha actually said that kind of in your daily life can bring about a sense of well-being and joy, I guess. One of them was having enough material things to get by. I've forgotten the other two because I've gone and said it. It's so embarrassing. The last one that I really like, though, is kind of translates as blamelessness. It's like not contributing as little as possible to the harm that is being done, which is really interesting from an environmental perspective, that you can have a level of joy from, say, putting solar panels on the roof, just by using less coal, for example. Yeah, so there's these, there are these...
Less plastic bags,
drive less, all sorts of things you can do. And instead of just thinking, oh, I should, my, Western Judeo kind of background guilt, I'm going to not do this. It's like, no, I'm going to not do it. I'm going to actually take some pleasure in not doing it just because I'm causing less harm, right? So there is this whole other aspect of it. But to come back to this, you need a level of hedonic to put it to the service of the gym. You need a level of hedonic happiness to even talk about genuine happiness. And then from there, it's a matter of putting those hedonic resources into the service of happiness. You need to look at those causes. What is it that brings about these levels of eudaimonic well-being? Right? What is it? And I presented some ideas, which is kindness, compassion, insight. So you want to see how much those resources can contribute to those causes. That's it. And so, you'll have to decide about shoes and surfboards and whatever it is, right? Like how much that really is contributing. That's not something there's not rules about that. But it comes down to what's your motivation to the actions that you're sort of carrying out. And that's where this sort of ethics thing sort of rolls back in, is that now we're going to operate in such a way that prioritizes these particular kind of qualities, these particular behaviors. And we're going to do them because we're going to get this payoff in the genuine side over here. So we're going to sort of use these resources. We're going to look at our motivation and what we can do with those actions and try to get the genuine payoff. And we see it in, you talk to very unreligious, unspiritual people who do volunteer work. They always say, I get more out of it than they do. And that's, you see that time and time again, because it's no surprise, because it's a sense of, again, being in service of your community, of others. So, and which is flagrant with direct contradiction to this sort of model where we see other people we can abstract them and then extract whatever we need and so on.
Sue Wall asked, could the third category be the benefit to humanity instead of in saying enlightenment or something, bring a benefit to it?
To me, it just still falls back into the eudaimonic, right? Being a benefit to humanity, even just trying to be a benefit to humanity. Yeah, the thing about this third type from a Buddhist perspective, just to maybe draw a line under it, these are permanent, right? So this isn't like just, this is permanent. So if you're talking about liberation, that, the prerequisite is these high levels of concentration that if you're an extraordinary human being, you could do in maybe 3 months if you went 10 to 12 hours a day in strict retreat and didn't talk to anyone. But unlikely, probably take 6 to 12 months. And even then, most of us wouldn't achieve it, which is not to say it can't be achieved, it can, but it's hard. And that's before we even get to the inside part. Yeah, and then you want to throw in these really high levels of, that's just for this liberation idea. Then there's this, step up to this, full enlightenment idea that the Buddha did, and that requires all this extra stuff, better insight, better, not better concentration, but better insight and more compassion and so on. So if we're going to talk about a third level, that's cool. We can throw it in there as being this, it's called Ngele. The best is like definite goodness is what people say. Yeah. It's a terrible translation, but that's...
And it has a correlation with the three types of suffering. They go together.
Yeah, it does. It has a correlation with three types of suffering. Look it up. I don't know. They go to three types of suffering. So, again, this idea of types of happiness, eudaimonic and hedonic, these are testable hypotheses. You can try them out yourself. They could function as, if this is how we ran with it, they could function as guidelines for this ethical application of technology. Right? This sort of blows out of the water the whole abstraction, extraction model that we're talking about. You say, what degree can I put hedonic resources to the service of the eudaimonic ones? Right? And that doesn't mean just giving everything away to people who need it, although that probably helps on this for the most part. But it's about the state of mind that you create by doing that. And of course, this idea of contemplative technology, that this attention training technology, right, this concentration that we're coming to, is what you sort of need now to support this ethical discipline. And it gets tricky. And so these start to overlap. I've laid it out. A bit of ethical discipline gives you some stability, then you develop concentration, and then you have this wisdom idea. And that's essentially how it works in a nutshell. But there's a lot of overlapping stuff because, for example, the biggest trouble we have, and so now I sort of pull back in for some sort of basic cognitive psychology understanding that, you know, we misinterpret things. Like we have these stimuli come to our senses and we interpret them in a particular way and we get things wrong. And one of the things we get wrong regularly is types of happiness. The problem, the only reason hedonic happiness causes any difficulties at all is because we treat it as genuine. And the only reason we treat it as genuine, and this is the, and you're all off the hook. I'm about to let you all off the hook, be ready. The reason we mistake hedonic for genuine is because for most of us, hedonic for genuine, is because the hedonic actually appears, we interpret it as genuine. And we go, oh, yeah, you know, another beer, another coffee, another whatever. It's a great idea, right? And so it's pretty easy to dispel logically. So this, if you want to go through this idea, so extremely hidden to manifest phenomena. It's pretty easy to test out because you think, well, if that's the case, you know, if let's say pizza, for example, let's say that pizza in front of me, it looks to me as if, because I certainly say I like pizza, it looks to me as if the pleasure I'm going to get from eating the pizza comes from the pizza. Is that all right? Am I weird or does everyone else think the same? Is that what it looks like to you? Yeah.
Yeah, especially if I don't have the pizza.
Yeah. Is anyone hungry? I should. So you have this idea, the pizza, and it really looks, that's the appearance. Okay. And this is fun for me because this is cognitive psychology and Buddhism, like teaming up and cheering each other on. So you've got the pizza, and now I'm like, oh yeah, there's enjoyment in the pizza, and it comes from the pizza because when I contact the pizza out there, right, then I feel pleasure. Hooray. But present a theory and say, actually, it's not. The pleasure's coming from your side, mostly. Let's not be controversial. It depends. Here's where you get it. It's a Buddhist side and it says all of it. The pleasure's coming from your side. And it's pretty easy to establish because if pizza were a source of happiness, the way for me to just be happy all the time would be to always be in contact with pizza. Right? Pizza, if it were a source of happiness to me, it could never turn to a source of suffering. I mean, this is pretty simple logic, isn't it? But it's not the case, if you've ever eaten too much pizza, substitute chocolate cake, substitute chocolate, substitute ice cream, whatever you like. These things that have appeared as a source of genuine sort of happiness that are going to trigger me, turns out they can turn into a source of suffering. Has anyone ever done that? Ever eaten too much pizza?
So pizza and a hangover, and then it's like, I'm never eating pizza again.
Yeah, never eating pizza again until the next time you're in. Yeah.
Until you forget.
Yeah, of course you do, which is how attachment works, right, from Buddhist perspective. And so that's what we do. We have these, what they are is delusions, actually. Like they're delusional because we're all delusional, so let's just relax into it. And that these appearances cause us the problem, and it takes, and you need to undo it all the time. I need to keep undoing these. So I get presented with a source of hedonic happiness. Am I interpreting it as genuine? Right? And the only way you can sort of kind of get under it and start to do that in the beginning is to be able to remember to kind of question it. And you may remember, right, that the word mindfulness really in Sanskrit and Tibetan just means remember. This is exactly what we use it for. What in Nagarjuna, this 12th century, maybe, Indian scholar I mentioned before, talks about what mindfulness is for, is to be able to ascertain what's helpful, what's harmful, and to reject the harmful and cultivate the beneficial. And that is to say, to make good judgment. So mindfulness is for, is to be able to make good judgments, and here's an example. Pizza. It's like, oh, I'm going to treat it as, it's appearing to me as genuine. It really looks as if that I'm going to, the enjoyment's coming from the pizza, and it's not at all the case. It's completely the reverse. All the enjoyment I'm getting from the pizza is coming from my side. It's just fascinating. It's coming from my side. But that's not the appearance and it's not my experience, but the logic is sound. Irrefutable, I would say. So what about that, right? Ethical discipline is not going to undo this, right? It's not going to undo it. That's where you start. This is where the technology starts to come into play, where we need to be able to examine this carefully and come to some sort of conclusion as to what we're going to do about it. And of course, as long as we are interpreting, I'll just say it again, as long as we are interpreting hedonic sources of happiness as eudaimonic sources of well-being, right, suffering is an absolute guarantee.
So share pizza therapy.
Share your pizza. Give it away. That's right. Or, of course, it becomes an opportunity for here's how it works. It becomes an opportunity for what we call insight meditation, right? It becomes an opportunity for insight meditation. So you have these things presented like that. It's things you have a really strong attachment to, come to attachment from a Buddhist perspective. Have a really strong attachment to, and need to get under it and undermine that. And that becomes this insight, you know, these Vipassana style meditations where you're analyzing the way it exists versus the way it appears. So cognitive psychologists would be saying, yeah, of course, that's cool. Buddhism was just saying, well, yeah, this is how you get under suffering altogether. Understand the discrepancy between the way things exist and the way they appear. And of course, you can do it for external objects. It's not so hard. It gets a lot harder when you start to talk about ourselves, which we'll come to. And so that's where we're at. And I like, I'm just going to play you a really short little video. And so you can see what I'm talking about, because it's a great example of like how the pizza analogy kind of works. Because it doesn't matter what you do, once you know what's going on here, it doesn't at all affect the way you perceive it. So there it is. That's the convex part. And it comes around to this side where it's painted, which is concave. No worries. Right? And then there's just nothing you can do about it, is there? The perception is just, yeah. It looks like it's convex. Then, yeah, you can even do this like that. And this is kind of the way this stuff is starting to work. This is how this, let's start with, you know, we're talking about ethics, which means we're talking about types of happiness, right? So you start to get interested in this. Well, if hedonic sources are being presented to me and they appear as genuine, yeah, I need to start undoing that. And it doesn't matter, just like this, the Einstein mask, the Einstein face, it doesn't matter what you do, it's for a long time, unless you do a lot of work, it's going to appear like that. So you need to actually start undermining the appearances, which is interesting, because by undermining the appearances, the point is to become less delusional. It's funny, isn't it? Because when we think about people being delusional, right, we think that, well, we're all seeing this and you're seeing something else, so you're delusional. Interesting, isn't it? What if you're sitting down with a heavyweight meditator, right? Done all this work on insight and everything, and you present them with pizza, okay? And we all go, oh, you know, there's happiness in the pizza coming to me. And then the one odd guy, well, let's make it a woman. The odd one woman out who's done all these years of retreat goes, oh, potential source of suffering. Who's delusional?
Actually, there was a question right at the beginning of the class about this exact thing from Liz about, If you were to ask a monk who's been meditating for like 15, 20 years what they learn about the mind, what would they tell us? So let's change it to a nun.
It depends, I guess.
It's a very Buddhist answer.
It's a very busy. It's also me putting words in mouths of people who've done a lot of stuff I haven't done. So I'm a bit sort of apprehensive, to be honest. I would assume, right, that they would say that, well, I've done as I was told, and I've looked for the things I was told to look for, and here's what I've seen. And presumably, you would, to put it in, to couch it in some terms it's easy to understand and shortcut. Presumably say, you know, at first, yeah, let's do this. At first, I noticed that there was motion, right, in the mind. There's mental activity, there's motion, right? And I observed, you know, I observed it, I didn't get caught up in it, and I noticed there was stillness. And I noticed that I could distinguish between the two. Okay. So just imagine this, you're sitting and you go, well, there's all these thoughts and ideas and rumination and all this stuff going on. And then there's also this awareness of that. So I've got the rumination and I've got my awareness of the rumination and they're arising together, but they're not the same thing. And I can differentiate between the two, I would imagine. So, okay. So I can tell the difference between the two. So, well, this is interesting. Then what do I want to identify with? If I look at the movement and just leave it alone, it's all sorts of stuff. There's really great stuff. There's really bad stuff. There's habitual things that I'm not very impressed with. There's actually, in amongst all that, if I get caught up and identify with that, there are definitely potential to lead me astray and cause me suffering, and perhaps worse still, cause other people suffering as well, based on things I might say and do, in motivated by all this mental movement, by this thought. So let's not get so interested. Let's take an interest over here. Let's take an interest in the stillness. Okay. So I've differentiated between motion and stillness. Now I've rested back in stillness and, well, okay, I'm going to examine this. Okay. I'm going to identify with this a little bit rather than the movement. And so more and more and more and more, you can get every layers of subtlety, 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 subtlety. And eventually at some point, you'd probably notice, you know, you'd probably be told to look for it. You'd probably see, you'd have the technology to experience firsthand that, objects, that appearances and awarenesses are indivisible in as much as they arise together. And when I start to examine my own mind, what happens is now I have this awareness of the awareness, because I'm not interested in movement anymore, remember? And now I'm interested in the stillness. And that stillness, turns out, was actually just my own sort of awareness. It was a thing that just illuminates things. And when I looked into that, what I've got is I had this awareness of awareness, which is confusing, right? Because I just got this awareness. But see, awarenesses can't arise unless there's an appearance, okay? I mean, I've just basically skipped forward to week 6, but don't worry, let's do it. Appearances can't arise without an awareness. Awareness can't arise without an appearance. There's no just awareness sitting around out there not aware of anything, or it's not an awareness. So you say, okay, so now that I'm not aware, I'm not even aware of the movement. I don't care about the movement. In fact, I've managed to steal that. And now I've got the awareness. So where's the awareness happening? What's it aware of? You know. And it turns out what it was aware of is it was just aware of the space in which it existed, which is the mental domain, right? It's not a physical thing, it's a mental domain. And here's where it gets confusing then, because I'm gonna add a third element. I have really good slides for this, so I'll do this again later. There's a third element. What I have is this. I have an awareness, right? I have an appearance. So that is to say, awareness and appearance. And then the action, this act of being aware. So I've got an action, right? I've got an agent, I've got an object. Is that okay? I have an awareness, an appearance, and the action of being. If you remove any one of those three things, the other two disappear. If the action of being aware, right, if that's removed, then the other two are gone. If the awareness is removed, the appearances are gone. If the appearance is removed, the awareness, it's all gone. It's really interesting. So now what would I do? And this is my Nyingma roots coming out here. What you would do is try to find the observer, try to observe the observer, which will get really interesting, because you can't. Because the second you observe the agent becomes the object, and the object becomes the agent, and it keeps doing this like shell game. You can't. And then eventually you go, fascinating, there isn't an observer. Like, you see it firsthand, you've got the technology. Oh, there isn't actually an observer as I predicted it. There is just this flat out sort of awareness and appearance, and that's it, right? And then once that's been done, which is pretty impressive, we're coming back to these permanent states. When that's done, then this person can get up and walk around and talk to all sorts of things and drink coffee and compare pizzas and all this sort of stuff, right? But they understand that the whole thing is operating is no more than appearance and awareness, and that every other bit, everything else, so there's an appearance and it's there, and there's an awareness and it's there, and every other thing is just a mental construct that's coming from my side being projected out there. All of it. And so with that in mind, not only can I know that it's a mental projection, but of course now I can control how I project. So how would I do that? Well, I would start to perceive as best I could. I would just start to see every living thing as a living thing trying to be happy and not suffer, right? Not only that, I go, because I don't understand how happiness works, what I would be seeing beings, or let's just say people, who are trying to be happy and not suffer and actually being kind of rubbish at it, right? And so then what happens? Well, you just have a natural sense of concern, compassion for that person and those people, and you'd want to do something, which you might not be able to do. That's what you'd want to do. And so if you're asking the question, which I've forgotten exactly what it was that what would somebody say if they've been meditating for 15 years full time? It depends, but one, there's a possibility. And if they meet up with a neuroscientist, the neuroscientist says, you know, wow, how did all that happen arising from your brain? Walk away. So that's one way of thinking about it. I don't know if that's helpful or not. And, you know, it works like this, I guess. If you put these up there, that's how it would work. You have this ethical discipline. And you'd be saying, oh, okay, I'm going to try to prioritize these genuine sources of genuine well-being, genuine happiness, eudaimonia. I'm going to put what hedonic resources arise to the service of that. I'm going to start to meditate. Go, okay, here we go. So now I stop lying, stealing, cheating, all this stuff. So great. Okay. And to keep going. So, okay, now I'm not doing any of those things. I can also take some joy, as the Buddha said, in this element of blamelessness. Oh, my level of harm in the outside world is much reduced. And you're allowed to feel happy about that, right? That's cool. So, okay, well, you know, now my problem now is that even though I know that the pizza, 100% of the enjoyment is coming from my side, even though I know that irrefutably, I haven't seen it for myself, it still looks to me like the pizza's coming the other way, which is a problem, because if I'm tired or hungry or something like this, I'm liable to fall back. If you think about, I have it for another reason, but I'll show you. If you think about this test we did on the first day, how you slow down over time, because you get worse at that response inhibition. So here's a great example. You put a pizza in front of me and I think, oh, you know, hedonic, not genuine. So there's this response inhibition, because all my habitual tendencies are, oh, a pizza, there's happiness in the pizza. The more pizza I have, the happier I'll be. Let's go. So you need some sort of sense of response inhibition to get under that. And of course, the more stressed I am and so on, the harder it is to do. So what beefs that up? What beefs up my percentages? What makes me, what increases my percentages of getting it right? You know, well, concentration is what does it. Mindfulness and introspection. That's what does it. So, okay. Now I'm going to train. So now what happens is I'm going to go into this, develop this technology which can cut through the noise, right? Can cut through this sort of atmospheric distortion. So that now the appearances of things as being genuine happiness get weaker and weaker and weaker, you know, or at least they don't influence my behavior so much. And then you flip over into this wisdom aspect, which is this vipassana, it is in Sanskrit. It means vipassana. It means in our context, because I, you know, trained in the Tibetan side of things, it means higher seeing things better, perceiving things better, perhaps cognizing them better. And so now that's what that's his analytical meditation. So it starts to analyze this. Oh, that's interesting. All these things are going on. If you push it far enough, you say, well, what I've got now is there's an appearance and an awareness. They're arising together. And, of course, this action of being aware. These things are all rising as you put the piece in front of me, and everything else, whether I think the pizza is good or bad. So I hate olives. I like pizza, but I hate olives. So you put an olive pizza in front of me, or you put some other pizza in front of me. Either way, whether I like it or not, is coming from my side. This is completely uncontroversial in Buddhism, and it won't raise much of an eyebrow in most cognitive psychology labs either. It's coming from my side. So then you can start to play with this, because you're actually, you know what? So now moving on to quantum physics, so I don't know if Martin's out there. I got a few emails during the week, and I said I wasn't going to talk about it today, but it's coming. But you know, you start to bring quantum physics into it. We know this already, that it's being constructed. Like, your whole reality is being constructed. It's uncontroversial that you are doing it. So why not choose how it's constructed in a way that is going to start to help train you habitually respond in such a way that's going to bring about sources of genuine rather than hedonic happiness? How are you going to do that? You're going to need to step back and understand that there's a discrepancy between the way things exist and the way they appear, and that we want to abandon when there are appearances that are causing us to act and say things that are causing harmony, to abandon those. And if there are appearances that are causing us to act and say in a way that are helpful, then that's cool. You can sort of hang, because, you know, we need concepts to talk. So that's okay. And then you start to abandon the ones that are causing harm and you cultivate the ones that are doing well. And then eventually you really, really hone, you start testing hypotheses. And then, you know, I gave a sort of hint to that, which is you drop back. One way of doing that would be to distinguish stillness from motion, right? That is, so now your awareness, and then turn your own observation and hypotheses and questions onto the observer. That's a fast track. There's another way. There's other ways. Certainly, I would imagine if you in here, Lanri Tangpa Center and other sister centers around the country, probably use what's called the four applications of mindfulness, right? Sometimes poorly translated as the four foundations of mindfulness, as applications of mindfulness. And so what they are then, that's this real hypothesis testing. That's like, well, okay, so you start with the body. So I've got my really super sort of high power telescope. I've got this shamatha, we call it, this high level of concentration. It's unswayed. This is literally like the Hubble telescope, free of atmospheric distortion. You know, you can look at anything. You don't have the Earth's messing it up, the atmosphere messing it up. That's what that mental does. It's true objectivity. It's a level of objectivity that science can't generate. It's impossible, right? And so, which is okay. That's not a problem. I'm just suggesting. And then you can examine things like the body, which is what you examine. So where this sense of self comes from. You did this, Liz. I know who Liz is. She asked this question. So then you've got this... So then you ask these questions about, well, how much of my sense of self, of me, is arising from the body, right? And then how much of it is solid? Because now you've got these, again, you've got these conceptions and so on. Then you move into the mental domain of feelings and then further into the mental domain and so on. Like, there are these four applications. We don't need to go into it in detail. But what they are, this is this hypothesis testing through which one probably depends, the idea is one actually perceives very, very clearly and directly or perceptually that, yeah, okay, there are all these things that I'm mistaken about, and a lot of them are causing me to act in ways that cause suffering. And now that I've seen them, you know, perceive them directly, I can operate from this new paradigm, right, in which I can construct my reality. I'm going to do it in such a way that I think will be the most beneficial to my community, to myself, to those around me, and so on. And then not only that, right, that as you construct that reality more and more and more, that just becomes your automatic response. His way of thinking about it, psychologists will be comfortable with. The same way that reading these words, right, is the automatic response, whereas the colors is secondary. Well, it's the same thing here. You just start constructing your reality in this way, and there it is. You've constructed in a way that's going to be beneficial for you and those around you. Oh, I forgot that I did this. And, you know, I'm just playing around now. But is that not going to work for me? Oh, yeah. And this is what it becomes, that every time you sort of see these sorts of things, then you sort of know that your perception's distorted. It's really helpful. How's that? Because that wasn't at all what I planned to do, but that has, right? Any questions, outbursts, objections? Hallelujahs.
There was a hallelujah from Pearly already tonight.
You're right, okay, good. Thanks, Pearly. I appreciate that. Because that's what we're getting at here. I wonder if I almost wish I could listen back to it. I'm not sure what I just said. But when you're looking at what contemplatives can bring to the table in this conversation, what they can bring to the table are these hypotheses that are far beyond the capacity currently of science to even come up with, let alone investigate. It isn't an indictment of science. It's first, and to be fair, science is like 400 years old. Psychology, what, 140 years old at the most? You know, and Buddhism's 2,500 years. So, you know, cut them some slack. But that's what we can bring to the table are these sorts of other ways of thinking and perhaps other hypotheses that can be tested and verified and we can look for certain measurements. There's an organization that I am lightly involved with called the Center for Contemplative Research. It's in Crestone, Colorado. And it has two main objectives. And one of them is the Mental Balance Initiative, which is what I'm a very small part of. And this is actually looking into these two types of happiness, eudaimonic and hedonic, and trying to operationalize and define eudaimonia, right? So it's been broken down into certain component parts. We're all sort of talking about that right now. And once that's done, there's going to be some tests on what manipulates that, and then, of course, an intervention that brings that about. Right. So it's really nice. It's a really scientific way of talking about coming up with Buddhist practice in a way. But there's a lot of non-Buddhists involved. And there's another one, which is people in long-term retreat. And long-term retreat means, you know, like years, the full-time study, full-time retreat. So, and so there are these two components happening here. In fact, it's a lovely story. Alan Wallace, he's been looking for this property for many, many years. He found the perfect property in Italy. I'd been there. It's like, it's everything you read in texts about places to meditate. It's far enough from the village you can't hear them, but close enough you can walk. There's sources of water. There's no, like, it's just everything that you read about a place to meditate. But he's had all these problems with the sort of trying to get the zoning regulations and all these things. It was such a shame. And then I think 3 years ago, a Carmelite, what do you call them, order? Nuns, Carmelite order? They were sort of winding things up in Colorado and moving on, and they sold the property to Alan at a huge discount because they were so interested in what he was doing. So he just walked into this, like, complete thing up in the mountains in Colorado designed for people to be in retreat. So that's up and running for a couple of years now, and they're building more and more cabins. And, again, a whole team of science, a whole team of researchers who are part of just what happens to these people when they're in these retreats for, you know, years at a time going full time. And what in what way might we be able to verify their discoveries, right, the hypothesis that they test? So the reason I bring this up is because I feel as if I've been a bit harsh sometimes on science, but actually there's a lot of really exciting stuff happening in, you know, in the mix of these two. It's just that it's taken the science side of things a little while to come around to the idea that the contemplatives actually have something to bring, which is, you know, let's just blame the behaviors, but blame for everything else.
There's a question here from Lou asking about, are you saying that something like clinical depression that's only controlled long-term, that it's actually your brain remembering depressive cognitive behavior? Is that what's going on, that it's not actually the depression that's going on, but your brain remembering that behavior?
So depression is a subjective experience of the person, right? And essentially it's from, you know, sadness. If you look at families of emotions, it comes from sadness, and it's basically sadness experienced at high levels and like higher intensity and more frequency. Yeah, essentially, like, if you want to really just tear it down. So, the question's a bit hard for me because your brain remembering is confusing for me. I'm not quite sure what that means exactly. You know, like, we give that this agency to the brain that confuses me. It's like, yeah, what basically happened? Here's a hypothesis to test, that there is a cognitive style that comes from catastrophizing and focusing in on you know, these negativity biases, right? And that is perhaps mediating neural pathways and speeding them up, which forms these habitual ways of thinking, which leads to depression. There is a possibility. There's another hypothesis. There's a chemical imbalance in the brain, right? And from that arises the subjective experience of depression. I mean, that is not a crazy idea, right? It's just that it's untested and it's hard to test. There's not many ethics committees will actually cut people's heads off.
Well, I'm not sure if you...
And so people talk about these memories being stored in the body. Some people allege that memories are stored in the brain, although, again, there's no evidence for this. I shouldn't say no, there's hardly any.
I say it's the experience.
The experience. Yeah, that's right, a flashback.
So let's use that. It's a really nice example. It's a really easy to use example, malleable example. It's not a good example. So you have somebody who's been a traumatic, you know, battle scene, seen their friends killed, something like this. A lot of first responders, if there's any first responders out there, you saw this stuff with the jumping castle in Tasmania and car crashes. This stuff happens all the time. And they can relive those experiences just, you know, in a flashback. Yeah. With or without an external stimuli. I mean, even without. And so there are these models. It's stored in the body, and these sorts of the vagus nerve and all these things, which undoubtedly, in my opinion, undoubtedly heavily influence the experience that you're having. No doubt. Okay. Is it the cause? Not really. Why? Well, because we're talking about the mind, and the mind is not physical. I'm just putting my Buddhist hat on because I'm allowed to. I'm usually so careful, I think, about being secular. I can do what I like now. So assuming that the mind is brain-based, or is, you know, consciousness comes from something physical, then all those theories are in play as causes, right? For me, I would say that they're in play as symptoms. They're in play as things you might be able to do to help, undoubtedly. But in terms of causes, no. And I've already mentioned it, I think, last week. This idea of cognitive fusion sort of speaks to this, that if I have a... it's possible to have a memory of something happen in the past and have it have no influence on me. It's also possible to have the same memory and have it and relive it. Yeah? Yeah, so I'm going to present a different way. This works, and it's a... I guess you just limit it. As long as you think it's all stored in the body and the brain and so on, you're a little bit... You're a bit limited. There's a lot you can do, right, and have a huge impact. Well, I'm just going to, because I'm running out of time. So, I would present it as a result of cognitive fusion, which is to say, having memories arise and treat them as the event instead of having, I can't remember if I used this terminology last week, but that we have mental activity, so in this case a memory, and then the referent, can't remember if I talked about this, yeah? There's a thing that it refers to, and they're not the same. So this is where vipassana, this is where insight meditation comes in. It's actually seeing directly that there is that mental activity and memories and so on are inert. Mental activity, whether it's a memory or just random imagery and all these sorts of things that despite Watson's best efforts do exist, all these sorts of things are harmless, 100% harmless. All your mental activity is completely harmless. Right? Can't do anything to completely 100% harmless. Is that clear? Do I need to say harmless one more time? Is anyone angry? It's harmless. What powers it up and makes it problematic is mistaking it for the event. So, like, you have all these other therapies, and so they're all really quite, what's the word, like really skillful, kind of intuitive, clever ways in, right? But they're not addressing the cause, because the fundamental cause will always, from a Buddhist perspective, come back to the mind. And so what's the mental activity? What's going on with the mental activity that's causing all this other stuff? And for the most part in psychology, we have to start with the other stuff, which is not useless, right? But it can take you a long way, but only so far. Whereas when you sort of look into the mental activity and what's going on, which is what these different types of meditation and hypothesis testing and so on is designed to do, then you are looking at ways of undermining it all together, so that rather than have the memory arise and then have to disengage, and do these really effective techniques and tools to mitigate the harm being done by a flashback, for example, you could have mental activity just arise and treat it for what it is, which is harmless. Doesn't mean that the event is unimportant. It just means the memory itself can't in and of itself do anything. And of course, the only way to really get to try that out is to actually develop the tools to see if that's true, right? You have to go in and you have to develop the ability to be still and have these things arise and say, if I treat them as mental activity, will they cause me harm? And of course, that takes some training. You can't do that right off the bat. But it can be done. I've been doing it for years with people. And then it all comes down to this idea again of cognitive fusion, and it does fall into this category I think I mentioned already of research, where people are suggesting that in terms of, say, post-traumatic stress and these sorts of things, it's not necessarily the content isn't the issue. Like the content of your memory isn't the main issue. The main issue is your relationship with the content. It was really, I almost fell off my chair when I read these papers, because they're using completely science. There's no mental stuff. They're all totally like. So I just, we've got to finish up. So the example is like, you've got, it's a nice one, like you've got someone who's, you know, seen a really serious car crash or something like this versus someone whose mother took their toy off them when they were 7 years old. Both of these can cause trauma for sure. In fact, they can cause equal levels of trauma, you know, surprisingly. And so apparently, and so I'm not really up on all this, I'm not a therapist. One way to deal with that is to go back into that memory and actually change the story and pretend, right, that your mother gave you the thing back. Just because we're running out of time, but the idea of resolution, and again, I'm not a therapist, I'm not a clinical psychologist, I've never claimed to be one. But in terms of like resolving trauma, it's interesting, isn't it? It's like, so when these things arise, you can like could change the memory to something that didn't happen.
It's like using imagination and meditation to become a Buddha and save everybody. It's the same imaginative process.
I don't think it's as helpful. Like, when you think about actually, it's still delusional. It's still like, I mean, remember, we're all delusional. It's a word I throw around a lot. I'm delusional too. It's okay, but it's this idea where we're not going to actually learn treat the mental activity as mental activity, right? We're going to treat it as this powered up thing that can drive responses. So I'm just going to, from a Buddhist perspective, you can get under that. Right, you can get under that and just treat the mental activity as mental activity, which is harmless. Right? That doesn't mean the rest of this other stuff is useless. In fact, I would say this other stuff you're talking about is a really helpful way into that. But in terms of, I'm just going to finish up, okay, because we're past 8 o'clock. Because in terms of processing it, here's the deal. Let's just look at the mind. If you're going to go back and remember something that happened and you cognitively fuse with it, you're going to relive it. So I would argue that until you can remember it and have it arise without cognitively fusing with it, so it just has no impact at all, you're delusional a little bit in relation. Harmfully delusional, because it can be helpfully delusional. It's going to cause you some problems, and this is the way under it. And there are meditation practices and to do this, which we can look at. One, you know, I'll give you a really banal example that how this works. If you're meditating, okay. And the thought just sort of drifts through your mind, I should get a cookie, right? I don't know if it depends how much you've meditated, but it's pretty easy for that thought just to meander through the mind and not do anything, right? Have no impact at all. The second the thought, I would like a cookie, arises in the mind, and I treat it as a fact, cognitively fused with it, I now have a subjective desire for a cookie, and I'm going to get up, maybe, and go get a cookie. So the mental activity isn't the issue, it's your treatment of it. And this is what we're looking at. And if you're going to talk about dealing with mental activity directly, you need to get into the mental domain. And the mental domain is only accessible, your mental domain is only accessible to you with the right training and the right technology. Ta-da. All right.
Mind blown.
you are free to go. I'll see you next time.
Thank you, Corey. Thank you, thank you.